All right, our next speaker this afternoon is Rabbi Micah Citrin. Rabbi Citrin is co-rabbi with his wife, Rabbi Karen Citrin, at Temple Israel here in Tulsa. Originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and a graduate of the University of Oregon, Rabbi Micah was ordained from the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Los Angeles in 2005 and also holds a master's degree in Jewish education from the Ray Hirsch School of Education. Please welcome Rabbi Micah Citrin.
Thank you so much for the warm welcome. I know that there's a long history of friendship between Temple Israel and Boston Avenue Methodist, so it's wonderful to be here and for Karen and me to continue that. Imam and Shasi, I did not think about 9/11 when we first met, but I did think, where did you get your yarmulke? Because it would be great for Shabbat for me, and since we have the same barber. Since I haven't used hair clips to keep these on in about 20 years, I can wear this to play basketball here without fear of this coming off. I want to just start out with definitions first, because the topic being extremism, I thought, well, what is extremism? How does the dictionary define extremism? And perhaps in some ways, what are the antecedents to extremism? And I thought, one ingredient that doesn't necessarily ensure that extremism will exist, but, and Imam and Shasi alluded to this, is present in many forms of extremism, including Jewish extremism, would be the notion of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism meaning that everything in the Bible is literally true, or in a broader sense, a strict adherence to basic principles. And sometimes that literalism and sometimes that strict adherence to basic principles translates to extremism when brought into the world. And so extremism, according to the Webster's Dictionary, is something that's far removed from the norm or the average, something that is immoderate or radical. And this suggests not only attitudes, an extreme attitude, but can suggest tactics as well, actions to realize a certain ideology or worldview. So I thought that was important to keep in mind. Additionally, I'll say that this topic is personally painful for me, and I think any of us who care about our religious traditions, when we think about our own extremists in our own tradition, it should evoke a sense of pain, but also one that should be faced with honesty and directly. I would also be transparent about my own biases, which is I'm a Reform rabbi, which means in the streams of Judaism, Reform Judaism is on the liberal end or the progressive end. So I would argue, and perhaps not for this session, though I'm going to touch a little bit on it at the end, that within Judaism, there's a lot within Judaism that chafes against extremism, built-in safeguards, perhaps, all the more so from a Reform Jewish perspective. So know that I'm bringing that perspective to bear when we talk about these things. And then finally, I would quote Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, an Orthodox rabbi and a pluralist, who says it's much easier to point fingers at, for me to point fingers at perhaps Orthodox Jews, or for me to point fingers at Christians or Muslims. And what Yitz Greenberg teaches is we should be our own biggest self-critics. So if I'm a Reform Jew, I should be the biggest self-critic of Reform Judaism. As a Jew, I should be the biggest self-critic of my people and my tradition. And if we look inward first in a reflective way, hopefully that will make a difference in combating extremism and bringing a little more humility to the world. In the next 10 minutes or so, I don't want to talk about a whole sweep of the roots of extremism in Judaism per se. I just want to show the face, or a face, I suppose, of Jewish extremism today. Oh, we can't see the face of Jewish... Can we just dim the lights? The face of... One face of Jewish extremism is here, and we'll just take a look at that face, and then we can turn the lights back on.
It's not a quick.
Okay, so it's not like Vayhi Or or Vayhi Choshech, let there be light or let there be dark. It's gradual. By the way, my Hebrew is good enough that I was understanding your Arabic and the roots, so that's... It's really a good picture. Maybe you're starting to see the bovine outline. And the color is... It's not brown, friends. It is red. So as it's coming... I'll keep going. It's red. The face or a face of Jewish extremism can be found in the face of our red cow. And particularly a specific cow named Melody the cow, who was born in 1996. I'll get there in just a moment. According to Gershom Gorenberg, author of The End of Days, Fundamentalism, and there she is. So this is good. You can see me, I think, and we can take a look at... This isn't Melody herself. This is just a picture of a red cow, a red heifer. But in Gershom Gorenberg's book... The End of Days, Fundamentalism, and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, he asserts that those who hold a radical vision of the end of days will continue to act politically and violently toward this end, a vision that is stark and narrow, a vision that draws a small boundary around who is saved and who is not. Well, Melody, a red heifer, was born in 1996 on an Orthodox farm in Israel, and it created quite a stir because she was born of a black and white Holstein mother, and she came out completely red. And this actually brought American press, it brought a parade of people in, and in response, columnist David Landau of the Haaretz newspaper, kind of the New York Times of Israel, who happens to be Orthodox, said the following about Melody. He called Melody a four-legged bomb, more dangerous than any terrorist. So why was this red cow a four-legged bomb? For that, we have to go back to Numbers 19. In Numbers 19, there's a strange and archaic ritual about a red heifer, free of blemish, completely red, never having had a yoke touch it. And this heifer was to be used in a sin-cleansing rite to purify anyone who came in contact with the dead. The cow was to be burned down to the ashes. Ashes were to be mixed with water. The water was to be sprinkled. Anyone who touched the ashes became unclean. Anyone who was unclean and then was touched by the mixture became clean. And you can't go to the temple without being ritually clean. So now you can start to perhaps see the progression of this. In order to approach the temple, in ancient days, you had to have the heifer to cleanse Israelites of those who were potentially contaminated by death or ritual impurities. Now, the rabbi from the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, emphasized the enigma of this ritual, suggesting that Numbers 19 was beyond human grasp, and he said it was to be obeyed just because God said so. It was one of the God said so rules, so to speak, which there are plenty. Now, this becomes, of course, a challenge for anyone who would, any Jew who would dream of rebuilding the temple, because you'd have to have this red heifer. But before we go on, I will say that they sort of waited with Melody, and she grew some white hairs, so that disqualified her. And she was able to live out her days, God willing, in peace, without making her way into a sin offering. So this ritual purification has to be complete first, or the ability to have it. And in fact, many Orthodox Jews in Israel will not ascend onto the Temple Mount in Jerusalem because they are impure. And if that's the spot where the temple was built, they don't want to go up there. Of course, there's another problem, because the Temple Mount, that real estate has been in use for the last 1,300 years. There's some buildings there that are important buildings for Muslims. The Dome of the Rock is there, the spot where Muhammad went up to heaven, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the Israeli government has had a policy of leaving the Temple Mount or the Al-Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary, in the hands of Muslims since Israel conquered the Old City in the Six-Day War. That area has been run by Muslim religious authorities. Now, within Israel today, there is a small extremist group dedicated to rebuilding the Third Temple. They've been making clothes for the priests, tools for sacrifice, and they believe that the temple is needed to bring the coming of the Messiah and the end of days. And of course, with the arrival of Melody in the late 90s, they were very excited. And if you did the math, she was born in 1996. 3 years after is when she would have been ready for this offering, which was right around the time of the millennium, when everyone was excited about the potential of the end of days. And interestingly enough, I was in seminary in Jerusalem at that time, and my seminary was right across Gei Ben Hinnom, the valley of Gehenna, from the walls of the old city. So we brought in the new year from the roof of seminary, watching and waiting. It was a great party. And of course, well, here we are. The notion of a rebuilt temple is an extreme vision. And even though parts of the Orthodox or classical liturgy, there's actual prayer for the rebuilding of the temple one day, mainstream Judaism, and I'm including Orthodoxy in this, would say that it's a matter of God's will. It's not up to human hands to force the Messiah. And in fact, people connected with this Temple Institute who would want to see the temple rebuilt have connections with people who have plotted to blow up the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the Israeli government has worked hard to stop these plots. After 2,000 years, personally as a Jew, it's hard to believe that we would pray for the return of the temple, because that means the return of sacrifice, not to mention all of the other mess that goes along with it, which is violent war, for the temple to be rebuilt. But it would also mean sacrifice. After 2,000 years of prayer, and the great scholar Maimonides says that God didn't even want sacrifice in the first place. The Israelites needed sacrifice coming out of the pagan lands of the Egyptians. And so instead of sacrificing to the pantheon of gods, they sacrifice to God. But prayer is in the correct evolution. Finally, in an odd interfaith twist, those engaged in seeking to rebuild the temple have joined forces with fundamentalist Christian groups here in the United States. One Pentecostal minister in particular, Clyde Lott, also a cattle man. He's connected with the Temple Institute, and they started to breed red heifers to bring on their vision of the end of days. But of course, this partnership is problematic, because the Christian vision of the end of days and the Jewish vision of the end of days is going to go like this in the end, right, in terms of who really is saved. And one extremist point of view can't give way to another. I want to close with a story from the Talmud that I think gets to the heart of a Jewish attitude towards extremism. There's a Talmudic debate about whether or not an oven is kosher, whether or not it's pure. And one rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer, a great rabbi, insists that the oven is pure, and the rest of the rabbis say no, it is not pure. And Rabbi Eliezer says, if I am right, let this carob tree outside the walls of the house of study get up and move 100 cubits. And sure enough, the tree gets up and moves. And the rabbis say, no, it is not pure. And so Eliezer says, well, then let this water channel flow backwards if I am right. And sure enough, the water channel flows backwards. And finally, Eliezer says, if I am right, let the walls of the house of study begin to collapse on us. And the walls start to collapse on the scholars. And Rabbi Yehoshua stands up and says, walls, what business is it of yours if we disagree? And so the walls stopped collapsing, but they remained at an incline out of respect for Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua. Well, finally, Rabbi Eliezer says, if I am right, let God prove it. And a heavenly voice comes forth, and the heavenly voice says, why do you argue with Rabbi Eliezer? He's always right. And Rabbi Joshua stood up and said, quoting Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 12, out of context, but that's what the rabbis like to do, stands up and says, the Torah is not in heaven. Meaning the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, and now it's up to us, up to people, to figure out what to do with it. Rabbi Eliezer was willing to bring the walls down on everyone just to show he was right. And even though he had God on his side, the reality is we don't have access to all of it. We don't know all of it. So we have to figure out with human means what that's going to be and how we're going to implement that. And I think it gives us a sense of humility and a sense that we have to work with one another and to potentially say, I think I know what God wants of me, or I know what God wants of me, but I could be wrong.